Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Paul Tough, writer and public speaker on education, inequality, and success. We're talking about his latest book, The Years That Matter Most: How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book. This book seems like it's the culmination of a long piece of research that you've been working on for years.
It's true. It took me about 6 years in total to report and write this book. It was a big project.
One of the things you did is you followed certain students through their experiences at college. That was fascinating. That was a very interesting part of the book. I mean, there's some of the students I was just really interested in what was going to happen, and especially Kiki Gilbert. Talk to me about that. How did you choose students?
It was a long process. So I spoke to more than 100 students at some length and did that for a couple of reasons. One was to try to get a full sense of the landscape of different experiences that students were having from different parts of the country, different sort of levels of selectivity of the institutions they were going to, but also because I wanted to find a few that I really wanted to stick with. And so Kiki was one of those.
The central topic, the overarching topic, and the idea behind this book is about social mobility and Ivy League colleges. And the more that I read your book, the angrier I got.
Right. And
just explain that. I mean, it really seems like everything is stacked against students of color and lower income students to get into the finest Ivy League schools.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, so I would say that that's certainly part of the book, but talking about Ivy League schools. To me, there's a broader problem those same inequities that exist in those most selective institutions, Ivy League and similar institutions. There are similar inequities that exist in public institutions, community colleges. It's the whole system is tilted in favor of people who have advantages already coming into it.
Well, let's talk about, you also track a lot of people who've done research data too. And let's start with Raj Shetty. Is that how you pronounce his name? Took a lot of RAS data and sort of created these mobility report cards. What was his findings?
Yeah, it was a remarkable study that Raj and a few different colleagues did, looking at tax records that went back generations. And he and his colleagues were able to use these records to trace the way that American families sort of rose and fell in the economic sphere, and the role that higher education played in the history of families doing better or doing worse. And the main finding that he had was that college plays a huge role in the mobility of individual American families. Going to college matters a lot, and the kind of college that you attend matters a lot. Young people who attended the most selective institutions of higher education, Ivy League and similar schools, had financial outcomes in their mid-30s that were much better than everybody else's. And the problem with that is that he also found that those most selective institutions, were admitting very few truly low-income students. At most Ivy League institutions, the percentage of the student body that comes from the bottom economic quintile, the bottom fifth of American families, is only 2 or 3% of the student body.
Didn't it end up that all the Ivy League schools were admitting exactly the same percentage of lower income students?
Of African American students.
Yeah.
So
it was like suspiciously the same number.
Yeah. They were admitting pretty similar. I mean, all of them were in the 2, 3, 4% range in terms of bottom quintile. The number that really stood out as being suspiciously similar was black students, African American students. So most of the Ivy League schools had exactly 8% of their student bodies black students. And that not only is consistent across a lot of these institutions, it also is consistent going back in time. I kept coming across references going back to the 80s in which Harvard had exactly 8% of its student body being black.
But, you know, they all say that, you know, they get grants for admitting lower-income students. But one of the things that other people and you have found out is they sort of really the students they admit are really close to that borderline of what determines poverty. So they don't really go for the really extremely poor students. They go for the ones that are almost not poor.
Yeah, this is so there are two ways of measuring family income. when you're looking at college admissions. And so the way that most institutions do it now is through eligibility for Pell Grants. That's the federal program for low-income students. And so the government, the institutions have to report to the government and thus to the public what percentage of their student body is Pell eligible. And over the past few years, that has actually been come to be something that colleges want to show, that they're very diverse, and so they're admitting lots of Pell-eligible students. What they don't report is what percentage of students are from each income quintile. Until Raj Chetty did his study, no one really knew that there were so few students coming from that very bottom income quintile. It's about half of students, maybe a little less than half of students, who are eligible for Pell grants. And so these two economists, Carolyn Hawksbee and Sarah Turner, did a study in which they looked, they put together these two different data points, and they found that colleges were sort of gaming the system to look like they were admitting a lot of low-income students by admitting as many Pell-eligible students as they could. But very few of those Pell-eligible students were truly low-income. They were getting as many students as possible who were exactly next to the Pell cutoff, to sort of boost those numbers, look more socioeconomically diverse than they really were.
Do these schools have any answers for what they're doing?
They didn't respond to those economists when they released that study last year. I mean, they talk a lot about the diversity of their classes, and they often are able to bring out numbers saying, we're getting more diverse, we're focusing on this, we're putting a lot of resources into diversity. And in lots of ways, that's a positive thing. I mean, I like the fact that they want at least to seem more diverse. But whenever you're able to get under the hood and really look at the numbers the way these economists have been able to do, it's hard to be persuaded that this is really a genuine effort.
And when a person does get admitted, say a person of color who is of low income, their experiences in the school can be really detrimental to their education. And I want to talk specifically about Kiki Gilbert, but other ones as too. She got into Princeton. Now, Princeton, 71%, this is from your books, of the students are from the top income quintile. So a person who's of lower income, whatever your background is, you're immediately going to feel disadvantaged. And you talk about why. I mean, the students are having lobster for supper. They're opting out of the meal plan and having lobster. And you feel that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the one distinction I would make from the way you described it is that experience, you know, being detrimental to Kiki's education. I mean, what I heard from Kiki and other first-generation and low-income students at highly selective institutions is that they were getting a good education. I mean, those institutions do a great job of educating their students and even of providing economic mobility. It was more that it was detrimental to their mental health, that it just feels so alienating to be suddenly as a middle class, working class young person or low income the way Kiki was, to be plunged into this community of such extreme affluence. And that's what most Ivy League and similar colleges are today. So for Kiki, it was just alienating and confusing to be around so much affluence. It also, you know, I think what happened to her is also true of a lot of other low income students who attend those institutions. It just made her mad. She felt
that's right. Yeah.
Like she was really understanding the way the American class system worked. And she was conscious that even if she was getting the boost from being a Princeton student, there were so many other qualified and deserving students from her neighborhood, from her social class, who weren't getting that same opportunity.
Well, one of the things that's mentioned in your book is the attitude toward that the affluent students have towards their classes, like within the classroom. And, you know, when Kiki and other lower-income students go to college, they have a vision of what college is supposed to be about. And they're there to work and to get on with their education. But there's this sort of like nonchalant attitude by the other students that sort of confounds them and actually angers them, because the other students are just in there like, whatever, you know, I don't care.
Yeah, there's this. I mean, I think they do care. I think
they care, but they put on this front.
Right, exactly. There's this way of being sort of intellectually cool if you are from that social class that is all about seeming, when you're in discussion sections at college, like you know, you're not taking this stuff seriously. And that is really a big distinction that, yeah, low-income students, in order to have overcome the disadvantages they had in elementary school and middle school and high school and make it to one of those institutions, they had to work enormously hard and take their educations very seriously. And they're usually from a family and from a culture that tells them, take your work very seriously. And then they hit this culture where, at least on the surface, affluent students are trained to do exactly the opposite, trained to seem really casual and nonchalant. And I think it's really another reason that it's so jarring for students like Kiki to get to those institutions.
Do these students eventually organize in some way so that they can find some, you know, other students that are like-minded?
Yeah, there's this relatively new organization that just was developed during the years that I was doing my reporting on this book, called IVG, for First Generation Ivy. And actually, at many highly selective institutions, there are now these institutions, these organizations of first generation and low income students that just give them an outlet, an identity, a way to connect and a way to share stories and feel some sense of community. And I think that's great. I think it's a really important development. I'm not sure how much will change in terms of actual policies or practices on the part of the universities. I hope a little bit. But I think more important, it just gives those students who in the past felt you know, even more like outsiders, a community and a connection on campus and across campuses that means a lot to them.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Paul Tough. He's a writer and a public speaker on education, inequality, and success. And we're talking about his latest book. It's an important read, The Years That Matter Most: How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul, one of the things you did is you tracked students before they even got into college and through the application process, and you found some interesting things. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So, I tried to meet students as early on in the process as I could, usually in junior year or just after, to watch the way that the divisions in higher education were forming. And so a lot of it has to do with the kind of preparation that students have, and especially preparation for the standardized tests that get so much weight in admissions these days. I spent some time with a high-priced SAT tutor in the Washington, D.C. suburbs named Ned Johnson, as he was giving his mostly affluent students training in how to beat the SAT and the ACT. And it was remarkable to watch because, you know, he gets paid $400 an hour, so he has very affluent students. And it was really working. He was able to improve their test scores by 100 or 200 points on the SAT, by 5, 6, 7, 8 points on the ACT. And that just gives those students so much more of a chance to be admitted to the most selective institutions. And that all came back to what their parents were able to afford. So after spending time with Ned, watching him boost his student scores, it was hard to take those tests as seriously as a true measure of student abilities.
Are some universities starting to recognize that maybe the SAT scores are not the most important thing to base admissions on?
They are, yeah. So more and more institutions, still a pretty small number, but more and more are going what they call test optional, meaning that if students don't want to submit their test scores when they apply, they can. And the reason for that, these test scores are not irrelevant. They are good indicators of how well students will do on average in college. But they're not as good as students' high school grades. The best predictor of how students will do is their high school grades. Adding the SAT or the ACT to that increases the predictivity, the degree to which you can predict how well a student will do, by a little bit. But the institutions that are going test optional, their argument is that for that little bit of extra certainty about who will succeed at your institution, you're also getting a lot of inequity because SAT scores and family incomes correlate so strongly.
There's a young woman at the beginning of the book that you follow through that application process, and there's a real fear of failure, of getting into college and failing. She had a brother that ends up washing out of college after the first year. Talk to me about that. I mean, a lot of students are like, well, I'll settle for this college. But the point of your book is that the reality of our economic system is you should go for the best college you can possibly get. and get into that one because they're going to spend more money per student and you'll get more out of it and your future income is dependent upon it.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's complicated about the decision is that, yeah, from an economic point of view, from the lens of just a strict economist, what you're saying is exactly right, that going to a more selective institution almost always leads to better financial outcomes. The downside is that it can often lead to some real unhappiness along the way. And so the student you're talking about is a young woman named Kim Henning from small town in western North Carolina in the Appalachian foothills. Her family's sort of a white, working-class, low-income family. And one of the things that really struck me talking to her was how important family is in the decisions of almost every young person on how and when and where to go to college. But especially I feel for those low-income students in her community, in Kim's community. No one was very supportive of her going to college. I think that was partly a cultural thing. It was just a part of the world where a part of the country where there's a lot of anti-college sentiment. And then partly, as you described, it was also the fact that her older brother a few years earlier had gone to college, been the first in the family to go off to a regional college, and flamed out. He just failed spectacularly in his first couple of years. And it saddled him with a lot of debt and no degree and not a lot of economic prospects, and gave the family, I think, more of a sense of skepticism and cynicism about what a college education could bring them. And so for her, she ended up not going to the most selective institution that she could have.
Because of fear of failure.
Yes, but I also, I mean, the thing about her decision, I think it was probably the right one for her. I mean, I do think there's something about this stratification of families into different college tiers that is problematic for the country as a whole. But for her as an individual, she went to Clemson, which is an excellent university, public university in South Carolina. She probably could have gone to a even more selective institution, but going to Clemson for her was the right compromise. It was a great institution, not too far away from home, didn't feel too jarring to her that the way she might have felt if she'd gone to a small liberal arts college in the Northeast. And she's doing great. You know, she's going to be a scientist. She's going to graduate on time. And so it's part of the complication of the book and part of why I wrote it the way that I did. There are these hard and fast rules you can get from the economics about what benefits a student the most, but there's also the reality of any individual student and his or her family and how higher education plays out in their lives.
Well, it sounds like another piece of this puzzle for success for the student is they have to have support from the family. They have to have emotional support from the family, not just financial support. They need a milieu that's really gearing them to go to college.
Yeah, I think it makes a big difference. And that's hard, I think, for a lot of those families. I mean, some of them, just like Kim's, genuinely don't want her to go away, don't believe in education, don't want to, just on an emotional level, don't want her to leave home and leave their culture. But even for families that are more supportive than Kim's, the obstacle, I think, for a lot of students is that their families just don't really know how to play the college game. If you're if no one in your family has ever gone to college, you don't know all the ins and outs of applications and deadlines and early admission and reference letters and all of the things that you need to succeed in a college application. And so the advantages that that families or that students have when their families have gone to college, sometimes for generations, you can measure them, you can see them, statistically, but they also go beyond those measurements. It's just a way it feels. If you're going to college and kind of fulfilling your family's destiny, it feels different than if you are the first one in your family and you're breaking away from the mold.
Didn't she have a problem initially, and then she dropped out, and she just went into an incredible depression?
Kim, yeah. So Kim had trouble actually just getting the money to pay for college. I mean, that's the other obstacle.
But there's a real touching part of your book where, if people aren't familiar with how these things can emotionally affect a person, I mean, she literally went into, it looked like, or sounded like, or read like, a genuine depression. She sat on the couch and barely did anything for months.
Yeah, she watched Grey's Anatomy.
That's right.
Season after season. I mean, it was kind of a remarkable moment for me. So she was about to start her freshman year at Clemson and suddenly came to understand that she didn't have her tuition covered, thought she could get what's called a Parent Plus loan, which is a pretty high interest loan for parents without great credit scores. and found out that her family's credit score was so low that they couldn't even get one of those loans, and no one in her family was able to co-sign a loan for her. And so this is an obstacle that a lot of low-income students face, that the college financing system is so challenging that they literally can't pay. And so this was in the August before her freshman year. She was about to go off to college.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah, you're right. She's just sort of collapsed onto the family couch and stayed there for a couple of weeks. And I think it was, genuine burnout and depression. But it was also, I think, sort of symbolic that she was collapsing into the waiting arms of her family. And they weren't exactly thrilled with the idea of her going off. And so for a couple of weeks, it felt right. It felt like, yeah, this is where I belong, back with my family. And then one of the remarkable things about Kim is she just sort of changed her mind.
She just decided,
this is not where I want to be, sitting on the couch watching Grey's Anatomy.
Wow.
I want to be at Clemson. And she figured out how to do it, how to become an in-state resident, got a job working in a pet grooming place nearby, and she had to put off enrolling for one semester for a few months, but really entirely on her own, she figured out how to get herself down there and finance her education. It's like way too much of a burden to put on an 18-year-old, but to Kim's credit, when that burden was placed on her, she figured out how to meet it.
I want to talk about one more researcher before we end the show. Anthony Abraham Jack, who was a Harvard sociologist, did some amazing ethnographic studies of the lives of first-generation students at elite universities. What did he find?
Yeah, he's a great scholar and just came out with a book himself earlier this year called The Privileged Poor. And so he found a lot of what we've been talking about, that first-generation low-income students, when they get to highly selective campuses, do feel really alienated and confused and often like outsiders. So even when they're succeeding economically, educationally, academically, they are often socially, psychologically, emotionally having a rough time. But the specific twist in his book that I found so interesting is that he found that many of the low-income students who are admitted to those highly selective institutions are students who spent all of their high school career at boarding schools or private schools on scholarship. So a lot of boarding schools and private schools will admit a few low-income, first-generation, often students of color, to scholarship programs. And it's those students who are recruited so heavily by those highly selective institutions. So his estimate is that about half of the students of color, black students, at the most selective institutions come through that route. And he calls them the privileged poor, and the low-income students who don't go to boarding schools, who just go straight to those highly selective institutions, he calls the doubly disadvantaged. And so they all have the same economic obstacles when they're there in college. But psychologically, the advantages that the privileged poor have is that they understand what it's like to be in a community of great privilege and to be a bit of an outsider, and they can play the game. They know the language, they know the clothes, they know what it feels like, and so they it's much smoother for them, the transition to college.
With all the findings in your book, it really seems like we should know what to do next. What are some of your ideas of how we can correct this?
Well, I think there are at least two ways that we could fix these things. I mean, so on the highly selective private end, it really is an admissions problem more than anything else. Part of the reason why these low-income students feel so alienated and alone when they get to these institutions is that there just are so few of them. Certainly those institutions should do more to make them feel welcome, but the best way they could make them feel welcome is to have a more socioeconomically diverse freshman class each year. And that's really just an admissions decision on the part of most of these institutions. The bigger change that I think has to happen is actually on the public side of higher education. Mm. Most American college students go to public institutions, not private institutions, and certainly most low-income and first-generation students. And it's those institutions that, at their best, are the great vehicles of social mobility in this country. And yet, over the past couple of decades, we have stopped funding them. We have pulled back our public funding of higher education by between 15% and 20% per student in almost every state in the country just since 2001. And that's at a moment when every other country in the world is spending lots more on public higher education, and when all the signs in the economy and the labor market are that we need more, better educated young college graduates. And so that's just sort of shooting ourselves in the foot, and it leads to more higher tuitions, it leads to more student debt, and it also leads to a less mobile population, especially among young people.
And that seems to be the big ideal. Social mobility, how did that become your issue?
It's a good question. I mean, I feel like it is a way of thinking about the class divide that I feel like is pretty American. Like, we don't all agree on tax policy. We don't all agree on, you know, who should have what. But we all agree, I think, that young people should have a fair shot at improving their outcomes if they're willing to work hard. And that's really what social mobility is. It's the ability of young people to change their class, to change their backgrounds. It's part of the sort of American ideal. The country was founded on that idea.
It seems like it's the ideal that everybody talks about. But then when it gets down to actually doing the work of making it happen is where the stall is.
Yeah, that's the thing about ideals. they don't always play out in real life. And it's also why I feel hopeful about this. You know, I mean, I do feel like we have fallen off a long way from that ideal. But I do feel like, you know, this goes deep in American history, in the American ethos. And so that's why I'm hopeful that if Americans sort of understand both the data and the stories of individual young people, they will choose to do things differently in the future.
It seems like support for the student from every angle. Yeah, they need some financial advice, but they need a lot of support at home is crucial.
Yeah, I mean, I think ideally it's great to get support in both those places. I feel like we, the public, have to recognize that there are some students who just aren't going to get that kind of support at home, We need, you know, both the institutions themselves and the public in all its forms has to find ways to compensate for that. And so, if you don't have parents who went to college, we can't write you off. You know, I feel like we need to substitute for that kind of parental help.
This is an amazing book. My guest tonight has been Paul Tough, writer and public speaker on education, inequality, and success. And the book is The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes Us or Breaks Us. It was a great read. Paul, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.